final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission: to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Crap!
Operator, give me the number for 911.
The preacher man says it's the end of time, and the Mississippi River, she's a gold dry. The interest is up and the stock market's down, and you're only getting mugged if you go downtown. I live back in the woods, you see. My woman and the kids and the dogs and me. I got a shotgun, a rifle, and a four-wheel drive, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. I can plow a field all day long. I can catch a cat. Fish from dusk till dawn. Make our own whiskey and our own smoke too. Ain't too many things these old boys can't do. We grow good old tomatoes and homemade wine, and country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. Because you can't starve us out and you can't make us run. Those women old boys raised on shotguns. We say grace, we say ma'am. If you ain't into that, we don't give a damn. We came from the West Virginia coal mines and the Rocky Mountains and the western skies. We can skin a buck, we can run a trot line, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. I had a good friend in New York City. He never called me by my name, just Hillbilly. My grandpa taught me how to live off the land, and his taught him to be a businessman. He used to send me pictures of the Broadway nights, and I'd send him some homemade wine. But he was killed by a man with a switchblade knife. For $43, my friend lost his life. I'd love to spit some beach nut in that dude's eyes and shoot him with my old 45, cause a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. North California and South Alabama and little towns all around this land.
a trot line, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. Country boy can survive. Country folks can survive.
thinking is going on in here? What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch it.
Let's bring the inductor basics to an end. Firstly, I prepared the small LED circuit, which is powered by a 230 volt to 15 volt RMS transformer. The output sine wave, with peaks up to 25 volts, powers the LED directly. And as everybody would assume, the LED dies in a blink of an eye. Now I connect my 1 Henry coil in series with the LED, and it lights up perfectly, with an RMS current flow of around 28 milliamps. But that is weird, because the resistance of the coil is only around 34.5 ohms. If I would replace it with a fitting resistor of around 33 ohms, by placing 3 100 ohm resistors in parallel, the LED would still get destroyed. So the conclusion has to be that the inductance itself creates another form of resistance, and it is called the reactance. This time, power does not get converted into heat like normal resistors would do, but in a magnetic field which builds up and collapses. Watch part 1 if you didn't know that yet. A negative effect of this is that power oscillates between our voltage source and load, which strains, for example, our power grid. This is also known as reactive power. We can also see that if I decrease the inductance by opening the iron core, much more current starts to flow rapidly, which means our reactance must have decreased because Ohm's law is still active. Less reactance means more current. Let's try another experiment where we can change the frequency of our sine wave. It's basically the same setup, just with less voltage and a function generator. We start off with a frequency of 50 Hz and can see that the LED is still quite bright. Now I raise the frequency up to 10 kHz and we notice that the LED gets dimmer. So bigger frequencies means more reactance and thus less current flows. Which makes sense, because the magnetic field still has the same build-up and collapse time, but the time where current can flow normally gets shorter. The final formula to calculate the inductive reactance looks like this. 2π multiplied by the frequency multiplied by the inductance. Since we know this is a variable resistor based on the frequency, we can build noise filters or music frequency filters quite easily. Here I did a small simulation in LTSpice to demonstrate that if we had a 5 kilo ohm resistor, we can keep out frequencies under 800 Hz with this high pass filter. Or we can keep out frequencies of above 800 Hz with this low pass filter. If we build this small circuit on a breadboard with an n-channel MOSFET, we can for example detect the high frequent audio signals in your favorite song. It's not that useful, but you can build upon that idea. Next, I hooked up my 1 Henry coil with a 10 ohm resistor to my 50 volt RMS transformer. If we take a look at the voltage and current form, we can clearly see that they are not lined up perfectly, like it would be with a simple resistor circuit. This is called a phase shift, and it can reach up to 90 degrees with an ideal inductive load. Here I can change it very easily, by playing around with the iron core. This means the phase shift is capable of telling you how much inductance is in your circuit or even in your power grid. Another example for this would be the small microwave motor, which as you can see is an inductive load because it creates a phase shift of around 36 degrees. At the end, I want to show you an inexpensive alternative to an RLC meter, which I often use to measure inductance or capacity. It's this so-called transistor tester, which you can get from Amazon or eBay for around 20 bucks. As you can see, the precision is quite good when I try to measure my big self-made coil. But for smaller ones, like this 80.6 microhenry coil, the resolution of the measuring range is just not big enough. It's still good though, for $20. It can also measure resistance, capacity, and even the gain of transistors. Very handy. And it's based on a German project from microcontroller.net, so you know it's gotta be good. There is a link to it in the video description, and if you buy one, you support my channel, which is awesome, by the way. With that being said, let's end the talk about coils here. I hope you liked this video. Don't forget to like, share, and subscribe. Stay creative, and I will see resistors, you next. Capacitors, and inductors or coils are the most important basic passive components in electronics. You can find coils very often in different situations. That's a coil, that's a coil, that's a coil. That is a motor, which consists of coils. That's a transformer, which is also made out of two coils. And that's a relay, which does also consist of a coil. You get what I mean. So in this video, let's talk about the basics of inductors and why they are so important. Let's get started. First of all, let's get one foundation straight. When current flows through a wire, it creates a magnetic field around it. More current means a bigger field. We can even measure this field by using my current probe, which then calculates it to a current value. But don't overdo the current flow, otherwise our wire can't handle it and starts glowing. This is actually one basic characteristic value of a coil, the maximum current. As an experiment, let's see how the voltage of our mains power looks like. It's a beautiful sine wave. Now I use the probe to see whether I'm a voltage source. This looks familiar. But why? Well, the magnetic field of our mains wires, which are all around us inside our volts, induce a small voltage onto us because we are basically a big antenna. Speaking of induction, we induce a voltage if a conductor moves inside a magnetic field, like a AC motor right here, or a DC motor, or when a magnetic field is changing its intensity, like it happens with all AC signals. But the magnetic field of plain wire is quite weak, and cannot even lift up this nail. That is why we can wind up our wire to create a bigger length, which increases our magnetic force. But it is still not strong enough, so we have to use a ferromagnetic material, for example iron, as a core to enhance our field. This does the trick. And we have successfully created an electromagnet. Relays use such a trick to trigger a switch that can handle high AC currents. Depending on the dimensions, windings and ferromagnetic core of your coil, it can create a weak or a strong field. This property is represented with the value inductance, which is measured in Henry. You can measure the inductance with an RLC meter, which is a bit expensive. Or you can calculate it through different measurements, but that is far beyond this basics video. Now let's see what a coil does in a DC circuit. In such a circuit, the voltage can only switch on or off. It's pretty simple. I simulated here with a square wave signal, which is connected to an amplifier and then a coil and LED with current limiting resistor. Normally, with a resistor-LED combination, the current would follow our voltage signal without a problem. But now with the coil, current does not follow our voltage immediately and takes a bit of time to reach its final state. With more inductance, this can take longer. And with less inductance of our coil, it can take less time. But why? The reason is called Lenz's law. The voltage at our circuit lets current flow. This current starts creating a magnetic field, which induces voltage into the coil itself, which produces an induced current. And Lenz's law says that such a current will always oppose the change it produces. Sounds complicated. But in a nutshell, it says we want current to flow, so our coil will hinder it as good as it can. Or we want current to stop flowing, so our coil will use the energy of its magnetic field to pump current into the circuit again and hinder us again as good as it can. Seems like coils are plain annoying, but we can use them to our advantage. The energy stored in an inductor is L divided by 2, multiplied by I squared, and we use this energy, for example in boost converters, to get 5 volts out of 3.7 volt batteries. Here is the circuit. Firstly, we close this switch to create the magnetic field around our coil. Then we open the switch. Now our coil pumps the energy into our circuit and raises the output voltage at the end. But we also have to be careful. Here I'm using a PWM signal to adjust the speed of a motor. Since the motor consists mostly of coils, we have a problem when our transistor switch closes. The coil tries to push the energy inside the open circuit, which produces a huge electron excess and thus big voltage spikes, which can easily destroy our transistor. So we use a flyback diode to protect our switch by offering the current a way to flow. Or we use a coil at the output of a step-down converter or switching power supply so that we have an energy storage which keeps our output voltage at a constant level. Now you know how inductors behave in DC circuits. Check back with part 2 to find out about frequency filters, reactants, and basically how coils behave in AC circuits. Until then, don't forget to like, share and subscribe for more electronics basics. Stay creative and I will see you next time.
Aw, crap!
Operator, give me the number for 911.
Hello everybody, you're listening to Mad Science with Shaziz, and I got Raymond on here. That little podcast that you played here on Shaziz Radio about coils and inductors and capacitors and such, whatever. Kind of made a blooper and played part two before I played part one, but that's okay because the most important thing that I wanted to talk about was actually in part one. It's at the very end whenever he was talking about the flyback diodes. Now I'll get into that in a second, but magnetic ballasts that people use for fluorescent lighting and stuff have some pretty amazing potentials to raise voltage up pretty high. And some of the modern day flyback or magnetic ballasts that they've got are pretty simple when it comes down to it. When in all reality, they only have a primary on there. And when you pulse that, anytime you induce a field in a coil of wire, a current in coil wire, you create a magnetic field. Well, when that magnetic field goes up and then collapses, it also drops pressure back in the other direction. So back to the flyback diode, what's the purpose of that? Well, you heard him in the podcast, if you were listening, talk about how that motors, which do have coils in there, when you pulse that coil or pulse that motor, that field is expanding and collapsing, and it can build up spikes inside that motor that energy wants to go somewhere, and it wants to go back into the circuit that is actually being used to pulse the circuit. And so in order to keep this energy from blowing out the circuit that is actually running the motor, they use a flyback diode to literally stop the flow from going back into the circuit and then send that energy off into a different circuit, such as a capacitor bank to store charge or whatever, or just bleed it off and get rid of it, period. So, what's the significance of all that? Well, back in the day, whenever they were making kerosene, they basically had a waste product that they couldn't get rid of. They couldn't figure out what to do with because it was too volatile. You know what that product was, Raymond? Look at your microphone mute.
I'm muted. I have no idea what it was. No.
Gasoline.
Oh, man.
Now, back in the day, whenever they were making kerosene, you know, because everybody used kerosene for lanterns and stuff like that, well, and heaters, kind of.
Oh, the byproduct. Yes.
Yeah, the byproduct of making the kerosene was gasoline, and so they couldn't get rid of it, so they were dumping it out. You know,
Yeah, they, in fact, they actually built berms outside the refineries. I mean, it covered like 4, 5, 6 acres, and they'd just push up dirt and build a berm and pour it in there and just let it evaporate into the air.
And so why would I bring up gasoline and kerosene, you know, and a byproduct and a waste product? Well, because in the fuel industry and in the gasoline industry back in them days, it was too volatile. It did, you know, it's too flammable, explosive. It you know, caused some serious damage. Well, you know, so they had to figure out something to do with it. Well, essentially, that's exactly what's going on in electricity today. Modern day electricity, the worst thing that you want in a circuit is a high voltage spike. If you get a high voltage spike, it can come back in and damage the chips in the like you say on your computer motherboard or any driver circuit you got for a motor. If that spike comes back in, it'll burn the doggone thing out. And what's the other thing that damages coils and motors? Heat, you know. Well, whereas back in the day, whenever they didn't want the gasoline because it was too dangerous, today they don't want the high voltage spikes because it's pretty much the same thing, dangerous, damaging, or whatever. So I'm sitting here thinking, why waste all that high voltage? And that's exactly what I'm looking for, is high voltage, because it's easy to energize gas into the plasma state using a high frequency, high voltage range that you can get off of pretty much any transformer. What do you think, Raymond? Ah, error, dead silence. That's terrible for radio.
I was getting ready to print something out, and I got a loud printer, so I had to mute my mic. Yeah, I think you're right, Shazam. I like it. I like your ideas. I like them a lot.
Well, go ahead and run your printer. I'll finish. Anyway, so basically, I wanted to play that little deal about the coils and different like the relay switches and stuff that he was talking about in there, because even electric motors in themselves have coils in them. Relay switches have coils in them, and anytime you induce a current in coil wire, you create a field. Wendt's law says that there's a counter field that's coming back to try to stop that. Well, that's because the electron flow that's going into energize the first magnetic field doesn't stop there. That energy makes a loop back around and goes back in and tries to start another magnetic field that's opposing the magnetic field that you started with, the one you want. And so the lens effect is what causes a whole lot of problems if you're trying to run a generator, especially. The more light bulbs you turn on, the stronger the lens effect gets, and the higher the amp draw, and so on and so forth, until eventually the thing locks itself down like a big old magnetic brake. Well, in order to not do that, you know, like you get you a regular generator, it'll tell you it's capable of this many watts or that many watts or whatever, and so how are they doing this inside this generator in order to be able to make one generator be able to handle 3,500 watts where another generator can handle 5,000 watts? You see what I'm saying here, man?
Yeah, I do. Yes, I do.
Well, if you're going to be inducing a current in a coil of wire, and it's going to create a magnetic field that's going to create an opposing magnetic field, that's essentially what we were talking about, nature balancing itself out. You know, you just put nature off balance when you induce this current, and nature's going to smack it back down to put it back where it was. Well, in the process of doing that, you get like back EMF is what they like to call it, or I like to call it a second electromagnetic field, or they like to call it Lenz law. There's so many different ways to call it, but either way, it's something that you don't want in most cases. But they figured out that with a magnetic ballast, they can use that effect to produce high voltage, because the more you keep pulsing this field, the higher the voltage gets. And the more rapid you pulse the field, the higher the voltage gets. So, They took made one coil of wire, put it on a core just like a transformer with only the primary, no secondary. See, in a microwave oven transformer, you got a primary winding that is energized by the AC current coming in from the wall. That fluctuating magnetic field is going up and hitting the secondary, which is energizing the secondary that has a whole bunch more turns of wire, but a lot thinner wire to build up the pressure, the higher the voltage, and then heats up the tungsten element inside the microwave oven magnetron, which then in turn produces heat and releases electrons inside of a vacuum that is surrounded by a guided magnetic field with one magnet on one side of the magnetron and another magnet on the other side of the magnetron. So the first magnet gets some spinning and the second magnet draws them forward to the antenna. As they're being drawn forward, those electrons get trapped up in these little tiny holes inside of a disc that's inside that vacuum in that magnetron, and then spin even faster, and by the time it ends up coming out of the antenna, creates a short, fast wave that is called a microwave and cooks your food. So, it's pretty easy to understand. You don't need a high current to produce high heat. If you could actually build a magnetron that was clear, where you could see inside of it to see what was actually going on in there, you would have the equivalence of a light bulb. That's it. A fancy light bulb with a nifty little trick inside to catch electrons.
Yeah.
And so you can see that high voltage, because of the frequency and how high it's vibrating, can literally produce heat that would be useful. Whereas in most circuitry, heat is the last thing you want, because heat destroys the insulation on the copper wire. Heat that will destroy circuitry, silicone chips in computers. That's why every single computer that you have has like fans inside of it, because you're pushing all this current through the doggone deal, and it's switching on and off and all this kind of stuff, but still the current, I'm echoing back through you, Raymond. The current is backing up behind that chip and basically producing heat. And so you have fans on there that will keep that thing cooled down. There's a heat sink on top of your processor and a fan that blow air across the heat sink to take that heat away from the transistor or the processors or any of the components that are getting hot because they're being run at a high frequency with a lot of current pushing behind them. So when I say a lot of current, for the actual size of the transistor. You know, a transistor, when you turn the voltage up on a transistor, that's when it gets hot. At low voltages, low current, it don't get hot. You don't need that until you start pushing a lot of voltage and current through that transistor. Then you need a heat sink on the back of that, some way to take away that heat, otherwise that part will literally destroy itself from the heat. So, knowing all this, and knowing that we can actually produce a lot of heat with high frequencies, why hasn't somebody already built a heating system that runs off of transistors?
That's an idea. That's a cool idea.
Well, if you've got a tungsten wire, and normally the tungsten wire actually requires a lot of current, and the current flow backing up inside there is what actually gives you your heat from your wattage and all that. And so because of the resistance of the flow in that tungsten, that current is causing that tungsten to get really hot. Well, if you could do the same exact thing, produce that heat with, instead of resistance, but the vibration of the high frequency, then you would get the same heat. You see what I'm saying?
Yes, I do. That's a cool idea.
Well, if you go look at a lot of these Tesla reproduction videos where people are doing experiments with, like Slayer exciters and Tesla coils and stuff, you can see that you can actually light a tungsten element bulb up. Matter of fact, when you was out here, we lit one up that was burnt out.
Yeah, we did. I remember that.
Yeah, and that was using high frequency. That was off the 20,000 volt oil burner igniter, 12 volt to 20,000 volt oil burner igniter.
9,000.
Yeah, running off a car battery. We took 12 volts, boosted it up to 20,000 volts, sent it in through that burnout light bulb, and actually lit it up.
Well, it was 20,000 volts and 35 milliamps.
Yeah.
You did it 35 or 350, I think it was 35.
But either way, after running that for a while, if you shut it off and then actually feel the glass on there, you'll feel that it's hot.
Yeah.
So you're actually producing heat with high voltage.
In fact, it got so hot, if you grabbed it while it was burning, you'd burn a blister on it.
Yep.
It would actually blister your fingers.
And if you actually watch some of these, where they take the either the Fisher Paco or the Samsung version of the smart drive or direct drive motors that they run in washing machines, and you spin them up, or the X13s, you spin them up, you'll get some pretty heck of arcs off of them doggone things, where it literally looks like fire, man.
Yeah, it'll burn a hole in you.
So if you can produce that much heat using just strictly high voltage alone, you know, once again, go back to the quoting the laws of physics where they say energy can neither be created nor destroyed, but it can be changed. All right, so what can you do with heat? There's a whole lot you can do with heat, man. You know, transfer that heat into water and boil the water into steam, or, you know, you can cook with the heat. So, if you had a transistor capable of running through some, even a multi-stage transistor system that was sending multiple frequencies through the same exact wire, but run off of the same power source, such as a 12-volt battery, you got these transistors kicking on and off so fast, and then while you're pulsing either coils, flyback transformers, The modern-day microwaves, it blew my mind, Raymond. I opened up a modern-day microwave, and you know that they don't have transformers in them anymore?
No, they do.
Nope, they don't. They got a, they call it an inverter technology that they have in there. Mm. And why they call it an inverter technology, I'm not exactly sure, because what it does is it takes high voltage, or it takes 120 volts AC, switches it over to a DC pulse, which pulses the equivalence of a flyback transformer that you see in TV sets.
Right.
And so that puts out about 4,000 volts that then in turn goes into the magnetron and heats the element up inside the magnetron, and the process is just like the regular microwave. In the older microwaves, they had a transformer that had a primary and a secondary on it that you would energize directly to the transformer, and that would step the voltage up to about 2,000 or more volts, and then energize the magnetron. The newer style uses less energy because you're not actually pulsing the transformer from the start, if you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah, I do.
You're taking that AC current and you're rectifying it into DC current, then pulsing a transistor, which is either a transistor or a MOSFET. I'm pretty sure it's a big, it's just a really good sized transistor. And that goes into a capacitor bank and basically pulses a flyback transformer.
That's cool.
Yeah, it is. So I was pretty impressed by it. But either way, that shows what I just got through talking about to be true, because you can produce a lot of heat with just high voltage alone. That's your radio or your telephone. Anyway, you can get a lot of heat off of high voltage, then that means that you don't need a lot of current flow in order to get things started. You can start off with a regular 120-volt AC and then work your way up to some serious high voltage. I think Raymond's got a phone call going on.
No, I had a wife coming in. She had music playing on her telephone.
Oh.
I didn't mind just for a minute.
Anyway, now I'm into plasma research. I'm not talking the hoodoo voodoo version of plasma. I'm talking about the visible light spectrum heat / plasma, you know, that you see like whenever you look at a plasma globe. And the reason why, one of the reasons why that I'm interested in plasma technology is for the heat, because the largest portion of your electric bill is going to be from your heat. It's going to be from heating and lighting, depending on how you do your lighting. And we've already pretty much got the lighting resolved to where you can actually drop your energy usage way down using different technologies like the modern LED strips that they use. And with the heating portion of it, now that's a big deal right there. How can you get a lot of heat for a little bit of energy? And I'm saying that instead of using a resistive load on basically how regular modern day electric heater works, is that you are literally creating a resistance inside that tungsten element that is a resistive load. That's why it takes so many watts, so many amps to run the doggone thing. And I don't believe you need it to do that, because I've seen that you can actually light up a light bulb with just high voltage alone. Now that same voltage wouldn't run your electric motors. It'd ruin them. But if you could build a circuit that's pretty much the same doggone thing as that circuit that they're using in the modern day microwaves. The modern day microwaves, do you realize how many watts that those things are capable of?
Yeah.
1,250 watts. Yeah, that's how much those modern day microwaves that don't have a transformer in there are producing, 1,250 watts with that circuitry.
You know, the experiments you and I did when I was up there in Missouri with you, using the 40,000 volt Beckett oil burner in there.
Yep.
We did up some T8 and T12 burnout fluorescent lights. But we only lit up one. When I came back, I ordered and got some Beckett oil burner igniters. And I've got a video on YouTube showing me lighting up 15 T8 lights. Now, T8s, according to the bulb on, it says they use 30 watts. Well, the ones that I got, I actually measured the wattage used, and they use 28 watts a piece. So 28 times 15, so it should take 420 watts to light up 15 bulbs. Yet I was lighting up 15 bulbs, 100 watt at dead at night, using 49 watts. So you're right.
See?
You're 100% right. You don't need all that wattage.
Inside that doggone thing, there's a whole lot of heat going on inside them bulbs. You know?
Mm-hmm.
People don't think about fluorescent bulbs actually getting hot, but one of the things that they do to start them doggone things is they heat up the gas inside there. You know, it's got a preheater on there. That's what that tungsten element is in at the end of each deal. And so that takes energy to preheat that bulb. Well, when you did your experiment, I saw your video, there wasn't no preheating involved. You just turned it on and bam, it was hot. It was ready to go.
The thing is, now, let's don't explain it in such a manner people get the wrong idea. When you say heat, you're talking about a different type of heat. You're talking about, the way you explained it to me is this energy is going through there, and it's exciting the atoms of the gases inside.
Yeah, producing friction, which in turn produces heat.
Infrared light, which you cannot see with the naked eye. However, when that infrared hits that white fluorescent powder, then it turns it to visible light. So that's why we're being able to use or create visible light. We're not heating it to the point that it gets hot to the touch. I mean, heat and cold, to me, heat is energy. And cold is nothing more than a minus energy.
Yeah, I don't know if you saw my last video that I put out there what was the name of that doggone video? Let me look. Oh, now I got it. Low RPM, high voltage. Alright, when I spun that thing up with a 18-volt cordless drill, now keep in mind, that's not very many RPMs. That thing was made for more for torque than it was for high speed.
Probably turning about 250 RPM.
Yeah, well, at that RPMs, I was able to produce high voltage using that ballast, if you watch the video, you'd see that there was some flaming arcs coming off of that thing. So, my key is that you get some pretty decent heat out of high voltage. You know, a lot of people don't want the high voltage portion of it. That's where the whole diode thing came in play there, the flyback diode, to keep the spikes are coming from that collapsing field to going back in there and frying out your circuitry. Otherwise, you turn it on running for a while and it'd burn out your circuit board.
Yep.
So, what they don't want is what I do want.
Right.
Because what is normally classified as waste or something that is an annoyance that you don't want in electric motor, have you ever seen how one side of an electric motor is actually grounded to the body of itself? Why do you think that is, man?
I have no idea.
Well, I'm kind of thinking because of what I've learned and listened to certain people talk about, because if you didn't have that, not only would it have that energy continue to rise inside that electric motor, that eventually, if it didn't destroy the circuit, it would burn the motor up, because the voltage spikes would continue to rise the more you ran it.
Right.
So you got to have a path for that stuff to go somewhere else. Get rid of it. And if they're trying to get rid of energy, then that tells me something that they probably didn't want me to know.
There you go.
So, if I pulse a magnetic ballast, and I keep pulsing that magnetic ballast, the voltage is going to keep spiking. And depending on how fast that I'm actually pulsing that, will determine how high those spikes will actually go before it finally levels itself out and can't go any higher. There's going to be a max ceiling there somewhere.
Right.
But in the meantime, if you just take any coil of wire, even just any coil, and tap it on a battery, as you pull off of that battery, you'll get a shock. Because when you first tap it, it basically creates an electromagnet if you got a piece of metal in between it. And then once you release that magnetism is flying right back to that doggone coil, and it's got to go somewhere. Which in this case would go through your finger, because you was holding both of the wires.
Right.
Now, so if you could actually take these diodes, these flyback diodes, and be able to pulse a circuit rapidly and not have that energy be able to go back into the circuitry so you don't destroy it, then you can pulse it all day long, and that circuit won't use any more energy than it actually takes to pulse that coil. But at the same time, you're going to get the flyback off of that. And that's what they do with these TVs to energize the inside, the older tube-type TVs and even the modern-day microwaves, is they want that flyback. So they deliberately create that flyback to raise the voltage up really high. voltage is pressure, and that's what I want. I want the voltage, I want the high pressure, I want the frequency range that the high voltage runs at. And the reason why I want that is because I want to be able to energize gas or vibrate a tungsten element to the point where it heats up and produces light. And if you can accomplish this with a small circuit that can pulse a coil rapidly and take away what would have normally been the waste. You see where I'm going with this, man?
Yes, I do.
Well, that's the key. I've got several driver circuits on the way to me, and as soon as I get these driver circuits, I'm actually going to be pulsing different transformers, because you can take any transformer out there. It doesn't matter which one you got. It doesn't matter what the secondary is, because you're not even going to use the secondary at first. You're just going to use the primary, and you're going to grab the flyback off the primary to watch the voltage spikes.
You know, you keep saying tungsten wire, but I'm wondering, would micro wire be better, or not quite as
well? Well, there's probably tons of different elements that they use in modern day bulbs that I'm not aware of. The only one I'm aware of at this point in time is tungsten that they use as the heating element inside there.
Tungsten is extremely expensive, and micro wire is dirt cheap. Dirt cheap.
Well, whenever, do they use them in light bulbs?
Yes, sir.
Well, then all you got to do is basically vibrate that until you get the heat that you want as well.
Right. So, microfiber heats up real good. It's got a lot of high resistance, and it'll take the heat even in the air.
That's impressive, because if you did that with tungsten would burn itself up in the air.
Yeah.
Yeah, tungsten would get so hot that it would just break in half.
I've got a bunch of tungsten rods that I use in my TIG motor.
Yeah?
I've got some 1/8 and some 5/32.
But you called it nichrome wire, is that what you said?
Nichrome wire, yeah, that's dirt cheap. It's like 10 or 15 cents a foot.
Do they use that in, styrofoam cutters?
Yes, that's exactly what they use it for.
Okay, see, now that's pretty impressive, because if it doesn't burn in half off of in the atmosphere, that's really impressive.
Now, it will if you put too much current to it.
Well, yeah, but does it get red hot
if you put it just right, you'll get super red hot, and just hold it right there. If you get the voltage and the amperage right, it'll take a lot of voltage, but it heats up really good with a lot of amperage.
Well, that's pretty good information there, man. I need to do some research on that wire, because that opens a whole lot of stuff.
If it's I built a bottle cutter to cut it to make drinking glasses out of, and use micro wire and a electric train rheostat, and I can just turn it real slow. You know, wrap the micro wire around the bottle. Turn it on real slow and let the wire heat up. When it got to a certain point where it was like glowing red,
yeah,
just stop right there and hold it just for a few seconds and take it out of the cutter and dip it in cold water, and it snap, clean as a whistle.
Wow. Well, you know what I'd like to see? I'd like to see somebody try to build a homemade light bulb with that wire.
Yeah.
That'd be cool.
That'd be fun. That would be fun.
And
I think next time I come, I'll bring a big glass container, my vacuum pump.
Tell me once again about. Did you just said you was cutting glass with that wire?
Yes.
And so basically, you wrapped a wire around there, you heated it up, and then cooled it down real quick, and
it snapped right where it's hot.
Ah, well, that's some useful information. How thick a glass you think that would work with?
Probably up to a half inch.
Well, cool, because I've found a section of basically a glass jar almost that they sell at the hobby shop that I wanted to build another plasma reactor, but I needed a thick glass to do it. And it's got an end on it, and I need to be able to cut that end off of it so that, you know, it's just a hollow tube.
Okay,
why
do you want to take the end off?
Because I need the other end to go to the other end of the plasma reactor. got to be able to put the probes in one end and seal it up, and then the probes in the other end and seal it up. I need a tube. I don't need a glass.
No, you take a diamond drill and just drill a hole and put your phones in that.
Well, that's possible.
Yep.
Yeah, well, see, that's why you need all these extra talents out there, because the cutting glass isn't one of my skills. So, anyway.
Flat sheets of glass, I can't cut that worth a tooth, but round bottles, yeah. And thick, I mean real thick, like real thick wine bottles.
Yeah.
They snap just as clean as a whistle. I mean clean.
Well, if I can get that done... Yeah, because I want to build another reactor, because the last one produced enough energy that it literally destroyed itself. So I know the I know what this technology is capable of doing, but I need to be able to build something that's not going to fall apart. You understand what I'm trying to say here?
Yes, I do. Oh, by the way, I lost your address. And I need you to send it to me later on today, because I got a bunch of stuff I want to send you. I was mainly responsible for messing up your, multimeter. Last time I was down there, I had you hook it up the wrong way, and it destroyed it. Well, anyway, I got you a couple more.
Oh, cool. I done went out and replaced those.
Well, good. Now you have more. I'm going to send you two more. You can't have enough of them, not for the kind of work you're doing.
Oh, yeah, no, it's aggravating when you get your favorite doggone multimeter fried out.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, I mean, you know, if you're doing two or three experiments, well, you have to have two multimeters with every one. One, you can measure the voltage, and you want to measure the amperage, but you want to do it at the same time. And here you've got two or three experiments side by side to show a difference. Well, then, okay, you got three of them, you need six multimeters.
Yep.
How many you got now?
Three.
Okay, I'm going to send you three more.
And one fried one.
One fried one. I bet you anything is not really fried. I bet you just a fuse inside is burnt out.
No, I replaced the fuse in the doggone thing, and this one, it literally got fried.
Okay, no.
It still shows numbers, but they're not like numbers that we recognize.
Hey, well, I bought about 10 or 12 of them yesterday in the yard sale. Brand spanking new, still in the blister pack. I got them for $1.50 a piece.
Cool.
Yeah.
That's all good.
I'm going to send you three of them. That way you don't have six.
All right. So anyway, I need to check out on eBay and find out how much these flyback diodes cost, and see what their maximum voltage they can handle. Because I've got about seven different circuits coming to test this theory that I'm talking about, where I can pulse coils. And basically, I need them flyback diodes to ensure that I don't burn those circuits up. You see what I mean? Because it sure does stink to pay for something and then turn it on and bam, you blowed it up. Oh, what do you say we take a music break or something, man?
Yeah.
All right. Get my brain back together. I got to find a good tune here.
All right. 100 ohm. 1N4007 diode. 1A, 1,000 volt rectifier diodes, motor, Schneider flyback. $5.29. You're talking about 5.2 cents a piece.
Cool.
How many you want?
Oh, I don't know. Probably two for every circuit, I guess. It's about 14 of them.
They don't let you buy a couple, but you gotta buy 100.
Alright, well, anyway, folks, you're listening to Mad Science. We're gonna take a quick music break and then we'll be right back with you. So stay tuned. Peace and love, everybody.
Alright.
Mm-hmm.
space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission:
to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
operator. Give me the number for 911.
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch it.
Hello, everybody. You're listening to Mad Science on www.shazizradio.com. If you want to join in on the chat, jump over there to www.shazizradio.com/superchat.html, where you not only get to talk to the people in the Shaziz Radio chat room, but you can talk to the people on the Awake Radio side as well. So, with that said, I got Raymond on here, I think. Still there, Raymond? Going once? He got his mic muted. Huh. Alright, while I had Raymond on here, maybe he'll show back up. Anyway, what I was talking about...
I was making too much noise for a radio station.
Huh?
I had to mute the mic. I was making too much noise.
Oh, yeah. See, this is why I like the Shaziz Radio deal, man, because it's like real people making real crazy mistakes while they're really live on air. Yeah. Hey, that adds some charisma to the whole scene, man. You know what I mean?
Yep.
So anyway, I'm talking about high voltage and pulsing coils and flyback diodes and stuff. Essentially, just like an internal combustion engine, you got things that you don't want to happen in an internal combustion engine. It's, to some extent, you want heat because you need a heater for your car. And, there are good purposes for the heat. But for the most part, an internal combustion engine produces too much heat. And if you take away the radiator and the water and a way to cool it, then literally that motor will destroy itself. They have air-cooled motors out there that they get pretty extremely hot, but they're specifically designed not to destroy themselves when they get hot. But even at that, if you push them too hard, they will get too hot and they will destroy themselves.
And that's one experiment I'm getting ready to work on. I've got, I just told you off the air, I've got 40 millimeter by 45 millimeter Peltier devices, and I'm going to build a muffler system for a small motor and do some testing and see if I can't make the electricity. If that works, then I'm going to build a big muffler system for my truck.
Yeah, see now.
See if I can't do away with the alternator altogether.
That would be brilliant, because we know that there's a lot of wasted energy in the internal combustion engine. And if you could find a way to monopolize on all that wasted energy, there's so many potentials even in electric motors that will get hot when they're running.
The thing that gets me is engineers over the years have figured out that this will do so much energy, that will do so much energy, blah, blah, blah. And the things I've read is, 1 horsepower gasoline motor, 743 watts. Well, what about the heat?
Yeah.
Well, what if you take a water cooling motor, and all of a sudden you redesign the radiator to where it's got Peltier devices on it, and then you put the fan, instead of running the air through the radiator, you run the fan on the Peltier devices.
You're
a lot more electricity, and the motor is turning a generator, but it's producing heat making electricity. The exhaust is producing heat making electricity. The exhaust is under pressure, therefore it could turn a small fan because you've already got the heat out of it. The fan blades being turning a generator. So I'm thinking that one horsepower can do a lot, and I do mean a lot more than 743 watts. Probably do about 1500.
There's two things: the secrets of the alternator and the heat coming off of that radiator system. And let's take for example a bus. A bus has multiple heater cores in it, so that it can heat the entire bus. Well, they circulate that water all the way through that entire bus. So there's a long length of hose that goes all the way to the back of the bus to one of the heater cores, which there's some on some buses, depending on how big it is, may have two or three all the way in the back. So essentially, you're pumping the water up out of the engine through the radiator to cool it down, because you don't want the temperature to get over, I think it's like 220 degrees that a bus temperature runs at. But you don't want it to get higher than that, because it'll start tearing itself up. And in a diesel engine, the cylinders are actually lubricated by the fuel, because it actually has oil in the fuel. So, you know, it's going to hold up to a whole lot more scrutiny than, say, an internal combustion engine, which shouldn't be running around about 180 to 200 max. 200, it's getting hot, right? And it's getting too hot. So, because it has its self-lubricated fuel inside there. It has oil coming up from the bottom of the pistons. Well, so with that said, you're able to heat the entire bus with the doggone waste heat off of the doggone motor, and you could at the same time use that same radiator cooling system, which would get hot enough to produce the temperature difference that the Peltier elements need in order to start producing electricity. Now,
you know, thing is, I mean, you don't need the heat to heat the bus in the summertime.
No.
But if you had the Peltier system set up, then you could actually make electricity and run an electric air conditioner, which would there again save you power on your engine on your bus. Because when you're running an air conditioner big enough for a bus, you're taking a lot of horsepower away from the motor.
Yeah, and that, and with the system that you're talking about doing, you're still going to be taking that waste heat away from the motor and using it to produce the electricity to produce the cooling effect in the bus.
Exactly. Exactly.
And so, back to the secrets of the alternator one, when you was talking earlier about how things produce so much energy, there's actually a book out there called Secrets of the Alternator that will show you how you can get 120 volts AC or more out of a doggone alternator just by taking the diodes out of an AC Delco motor or alternator. That thing will produce a lot of voltage, AC current.
Back in the late 60s, I went to an automotive parts store, and I bought a little box. It, all it was, really and truly, the only thing it was a duplex electrical metal outlet. And inside, it had a duplex outlet plug on it, but inside was some tiny electronic parts, and you wired it into your alternator, and when you flip the switch, it would turn your alternator off to your battery, and turn all the current from the alternator into it. And when it put out, well, depending on the RPMs of your motor, you remember had to take a screwdriver and turn the idle up just a little bit, get it up about 900 to 1,000 RPMs, and it would put out 110 volts. But the thing is, it put out 110 volts of pulsating DC, not AC.
Yeah, but see, you can use either one to run an AC motor.
Well, the thing is, pulsating DC is three times more powerful per volt than AC current.
Yep.
Like, for example, a drill motor. I mean, I had a GE who was all aluminum housing, GE 3/8 inch drill motor, 110 volts. And my natural neighbor turned it on, got it wound up full speed, and grabbed it and just barged it right down and stopped it. But 75 volts of pulsating DC, from a dead stop, which is a lot easier, he could not hold it back. I mean, that almost peeled the meat off the inside of his hand, and that was only 75 volts.
Yeah.
Pulsating DC will give an electric motor a lot more power per voltage.
Also, the old style generators like they had in Volkswagens and cars before the alternator, they had to have a doggone voltage regulator, because otherwise that generator, when you wrapped out your engine, it would produce so much voltage that it would literally destroy your doggone wiring in your car.
Yes, it would. I know exactly what you're talking about.
So that's why they had to have a voltage regulator. They got fuses in cars for a reason. In case something goes wrong, you don't end up with a wire fire.
Yeah, I remember the old colors. I mean, you pull up to a stop light or a stop sign, and your headlights would just kind of like dim right down. And
yep.
Of course, when the light changed, or even traffic cleared, and you took off, your bright lights would work. The faster you went, the brighter they'd be.
Yep.
Oh, man.
Well, see, that should have been something that people paid attention to all those years. See, the alternator or the generator, either one can produce a lot more than you're actually using.
Yes.
You know, we could take any generator head out there. It doesn't matter, no specific name brand. If you got, like, let's say you got a 12K generator head. And normally, it takes pretty good horsepower to turn that when it's under a load because, you know, the back EMF or the lens effect that's going on. But if you was able to take that same exact generator head and instead of putting it under a direct load, spin that thing up to about 50,000 RPMs. Could you imagine the voltage that would come up out of that puppy?
Wow. you know, the voltage and RPMs of your generator are exponential. Money has brought that up.
Yeah.
Conversations. You take, for example, generator. My figure is not going to be correct, but I'm just saying if you turn 100 RPM and it's knocking out 10 volts, well, you figure if you turn it 1,000 RPM, it'll knock out 100. No, it'll knock out almost double, maybe even triple. It's not directly proportional. At 100 RPMs to knock out 10 volts, you'd think at 200 to knock out 20. No, it'll knock out 25 or 30.
Well,
the faster it goes, the more volts per RPM it'll put out.
Yeah, I showed that with a hard drive motor. I was spinning the hard drive motor up some pretty good RPMs, and I was getting out some really good high voltage out of that thing.
I've got a generator here that it's an alternator, permanent magnet alternator, but at 850 RPM, it'll put out 120 volts and 20 kilowatts, 20,000 watts. At 850 RPM. I'm just wondering what that sucker would do winding up about 30,000 RPM.
Well, think about that kind of voltage, how much heat you could get running that kind of voltage through, let's say, a coil of wire such as that wire you mentioned earlier that basically...
Nichrome wire?
Yeah, the nichrome wire.
Okay.
Now, if in the atmosphere that nichrome wire would burn up under that kind of voltage, then you should be able to put that in a vacuum and not be able to burn it up.
Right.
But you still be able to get some pretty amazing light out of it. Huh?
Yeah. Either a vacuum or argon gas.
Yeah. So, there's all kinds of potential with high voltage, and the only reason why I'm so interested in high voltage is because voltage is pressure, and I want to be able to move energy from point A to point B rapidly.
Right.
And the modern day capacitor technology, especially with what Robert Murray Smith is working on, is essentially you know, what is needed to start storing that energy as fast as possible. Now, it's really super simple to build a capacitor. I mean, just a couple plates and a dielectric in the middle or whatever. You know, you got a capacitor. Two pieces of aluminum foil and some wax paper. You got a capacitor.
Yeah.
So, imagine a 50-gallon drum size capacitor. And you were pumping high voltage into that at a rapid rate. Think about the power output on the other side.
That'd be killer.
You definitely, yeah, it would be killer. You wouldn't want to run over and put your tongue on it, that's for sure.
For real.
It'd probably put you into the next time zone or maybe
really, truly,
next dimension.
Pastor, that big, fully charged?
Yeah.
You wouldn't be able to put your tongue on it because it'd knock the...
Yeah, before you even got close. Well, that's why... The whole deal, whenever they got some of these transformers, they got these things that they'll short out the transformer so that when they're sitting there being stored, that they don't build up a charge. Because did you know that things could actually build up a charge when they're not plugged in?
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes them really dangerous because you know, like an 800 microfarad capacitor, which is probably about the size of a soda can. You know, that's probably a lot, there's some probably a lot smaller than that, but the one I got, an 800 microfarad capacitor will blow your thumb right off your hand. That's how much power they can store in there.
Wow.
Now, you can imagine what a transformer would do if it sat there and charged itself up, because essentially it's a capacitor.
You know, one of my welding machines is made at the factory this way, that when you turn it off, the cooling fans for the coils and in it, they keep on running for a good 15, 20 seconds, and I thought it was broke. I called the guy I bought it from. He said, no, he said, the new machines are designed that way, so what it does is it drains down the capacitors, and at the same time, it keeps uses the electricity stored in the capacitor to run the cooling fan, because the moment you turn the machine off, it's not cool. It doesn't cool instantly. So it drains the capacitors, and so it's safe to work on, and keeps your coils from burning up from the excess heat.
Yeah.
So I thought it pretty cool.
Well, the key thing about that whole deal is the fact that you're talking about they're trying to figure out ways to tame energy down, because they're realizing that they're getting too much power, you know?
Right.
You can't just take any average generator and run it direct to a load. You know, like let's say you got just a 500-watt generator, and you got it hooked to 150-watt light bulb. Well,
right.
At normal speeds, it might be running just right, you know? I'm going to add Buddy to the call if I can get him in here. At normal speeds, it might be running just right.
Right.
But you raise the RPMs up on there, and it won't take long at all before that doggone light bulb burns out. See what I'm saying?
Wait, real quick.
And get it Muddy in here. Hopefully he'll pick up. Dad, burn it. I got everybody calling in. Hold on, I'll see if I can get Justin in here too.
Good morning, sunshine, and good morning, sunshine.
Hey, how's it going, man?
Oh, having a ball as usual. Feeling much better than I did.
I heard you were sick yesterday.
Yeah, I had a fever going the day before. At the end of work, I wound up with a nosebleed that would not quit. And
a nosebleed? Did you get in a fight?
It went between a stream and a drip, and back and forth. And then when talking to Jim for a bit, it started all over again. I held the towel up to my nose.
Yeah, did you get in a fight?
Just like drive one-handed going home. One hand on the shifter, one hand on the steering wheel, then one hand back on the shifter, then one hand. And it happened about 4:30 that morning, too, beforehand. So, yeah, it was just something going around. And it had a lot to do with the dry air. Sinuses stretching as they shrink, you know.
So you didn't get into a fight?
Oh, no. But all I had was one piece of wood to put down in the bathroom. And I said, Trampas, shine, Bubba, shine. He was laughing. But he was worried. He was pretty worried. I was worried at first. I said, doggone, man. 4:30 in the morning, and then by the time... it was about 4:30 in the afternoon, come to think of it, as well. Like 12 hours between. But hadn't had no problem with blowing my nose pretty hard yesterday to make sure it was all clear. Feeling much better today.
Now that we got your blowing your nose thing out of the whack.
I know, talking about snots in the morning and bloody snots.
We're live on air, by the way.
Oh, yeah, I know that. I'm drinking my coffee, and it doesn't affect me either. So.
Well, I hope you get to feeling better. So, we've been joined by Justin, Muddy, with the bloody nose that's dried out for the moment, and hopefully he don't bleed no more during the show, but and we got Raymond in here.
That was a bloody rough day.
Hey, that kind of sound like English or British or something like that. Can you say it with the accent?
It was a bloody rough day.
Oh, well, don't give up your day job.
Yeah,
well.
All right, so anyway, what we've been talking about before when you finally woke up and joined us and everything.
You just ain't been paying attention to the chat.
Oh, yeah, I've been paying a little bit of attention to the chat. I had to take out a foul mouth comment in there. We don't allow that on my network, got all the filthy language stuff, crazy people. So be nice to each other, speak respectfully, and everything's cool. Alright. So, anyway, we're talking about flyback and flyback diodes and high voltage and, you know, the good portions of that.
Anyway. Are you playing that podcast right now, Shazis?
No, we're live, man.
Oh, because there was something else that was playing in the chat room.
Yeah, that was earlier.
Oh, okay. Yeah, you were talking about the capacitors using 50-gallon drums.
Yeah.
And Raymond was talking about DC power being more powerful, yeah.
Yeah, that was live.
Torque on the motor.
Yeah. I wouldn't want to use a big capacitor to start with because frequency is all about time. It's measured in time hertz, right? So if you start with high frequency and you couple the top of that secondary coil to your torad and you make a spark gap, another spark gap. You cover that spark gap, that torad, with another, what we would call a hood. What Tesla calls it is a hood in the cup, right? Now, when you do that, it all gets directed through an electromagnetic waveguide, which is what makes it a waveguide, because it makes it directional in one direction. You can make that spark gap bigger or smaller. That spark gap is what we're obtaining all that breako gets captured and forced up the tube, and then over a big surface area it acts like a big capacitor. There's another plate above that one which has the total height and gives it a potential difference from the ground, acting as the top of the capacitor. When they both meet each other, it disperses. It's a non-nuclear electromagnetic pulse.
Yeah, but see, Justin, see, I'm not arguing with you, but did you see my video called Unsubscribe?
Yeah, I've seen all kinds of your videos.
Yeah, well, my video called Unsubscribe showed something in that video, and essentially, I do want a 50-gallon drum-sized capacitor, and the reason being is the same reason why that in that video I showed that I had a very large capacitor bank with over 1.5 million microfarads that was actually running a circuit that should not have been running. See, the big storage deal is just that. It's a storage deal. And essentially what we're talking about is taking all this energy, filling in like the equivalence of an Olympic-sized swimming pool. Alright? And so everything else below that, you're not going to be using it on, like, say, a Tesla coil or anything like that. Everything below that has a smaller storage capacity. And so as long as the large capacity stays full and never gets dry enough, then everything below that will stay constant and run. You see what I'm saying here?
I thought you were going to use this to power a Tesla coil.
No. No, we're just using it as a storage bank, essentially. That's it. We want all that energy to be able to travel from point A to point B as rapidly as possible to pressurize a container that will store the energy, and then in turn feed that energy down into smaller ones, and you can have as many small ones as you want on the other end. As long as that big one never goes empty, then the smaller ones will be topped off at all times. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I understand exactly what you're saying.
It's all about the depletion rate of that capacitor. Everything is a capacitor. Anything with mass is a capacitor.
Yeah, see, normally capacitors are dangerous because if you don't have a load already connected to it, then it has a big stored potential behind it. So if you get too close to it and a large capacitor like that, and that stored potential is released, then you get some damage. You see what I mean?
No different than the Ark of the Covenant.
Yeah, well,
I used to make capacitors when I was a kid. I used to take the newspaper when it came in, and I'd take a couple rolls of aluminum foil, and I'd roll them suckers up tight like a log. The newspaper's bigger than the aluminum foil, so all you had to do is lay a layer of newspaper, and go ahead and overlap them, make it as long as your floor. Then you go ahead and pull out the aluminum foil after you've wrapped it around a piece of copper wire that you've already sanded. You twisted it up nice and tight. And you stick that so far into the roll. And then you go ahead and start your next roll of paper. And you run that out there to the length of the floor. And in just a little part of the ring, you do the same thing with your next roll of aluminum foil. And just keep it all straight as you roll it. Keep it tight. Man, I'd have this log about 2 inches in diameter by the time I got to the end. And I never added more than that. I when I was working at the TV station as KTXS Television as a studio engineer and tech, I found all these bad capacitors and stuff. We used to stick them at the end of an extension cord and stick them in a tin trash can and throw a bunch of paper on the top and put the lid on there lightly, and man, we used to just plug in things in, blow the paper out of the barrel. We thought that was kind of fun, so I was going to make a big one. And you know what? I plugged that sucker into the wall, and I did the same thing. Nothing. But I tell you what, it did work as a good battery. I mean, it had I don't know how many farads it was. I never did a time constant check on it, but them suckers worked, and I was amazed. It was able to handle the watts straight from the wall, and they didn't blow up. So,
Buddy,
it was able to hold the voltage wonderfully.
Buddy, have you seen the insides of the newer microwave ovens?
The newer ones? No, I have not.
They do not have a microwave oven transformer anymore. Inverter technology.
Yep, it's all like little capacitors, a couple MOSFETs.
Yep, and a flyback.
Yep.
So this system that they got now basically takes 120 volts AC, depending on which country you're in. Some overseas would be 220 or whatever, but either way, it takes 120 volts AC, rectifies it into DC current, which in turn runs the MOSFETs like he was talking about, that charges capacitors and pulses a primary on a flyback transformer. And out the other end, they get 4,000 volts.
It's also because the primary braided, too. It's twisted and braided.
Yeah.
Which allows it to be amplified in a single winding instead of several windings up a conductor, like up the rod.
So, either way, basically, what you got going on is a more efficient way to run a magnetron. You know, because the 4,000 volts is actually enough to heat up the element inside the doggone magnetron, which releases electrons inside the vacuum, and then in turn, produces the microwave out the other end.
Yeah, it doesn't matter how you achieve frequency. All you're trying to do is like a bottle. You're trying to blow in that magnetron to get it to make that humming noise. That's all we're trying to do. So if you achieve it through a Rumkopf coil or a different kind of inductor or through transistors, it doesn't matter as long as you're getting up to that resonant frequency.
So, I'm getting distracted again by the whole Tesla One inside the doggone chat room. Anybody know who that is?
Probably a troll.
No, we ain't got the trolls.
Either way, look.
Who knows? It could be Ryan Abrams.
Ryan.
He's not a troll.
Ryan wouldn't do that. Ryan's a good guy. Anyway, so basically what I'm trying to point out here is that what normally people didn't want happen with the high voltage and all that is what we do want happening. Everybody went to sleep on me. Alright, for the specific design that I'm talking about, I want the high voltage. I want the high frequency and I want the flyback. I want what they don't want in your average circuit. When you pulse a coil, if you don't have nothing in between the driver circuit and that coil, it will literally ramp itself up until eventually those high voltage spikes will come back in and fry out your transistors.
Right.
All right, so that's the basics.
Standing wave ratios.
Yeah. This radio silence is deafening.
You know, you keep talking about high voltage, and I've asked you at least 5 or 6 times, how much voltage do you want? And you never have one time given me a specific.
Well, I want it to be super high, you know, but I don't need it to be super high. About 4,000 volts would be plenty enough for what I'm talking about.
So my ideas are not going to be all that great.
What idea was that?
I've got some tasers that put out 20 million volts, but they only do it for a few seconds at a time, and I was kind of hoping you and I could take one apart and see if we couldn't retrofit the daggone thing where it would work continuously.
No, that's not a bad idea, because basically the higher the voltage, the faster the result that I'm looking for.
Well, I also have one taser that put out 89 million volts.
That's a lot of voltage, man.
Yes, it is.
So, at that point in time, does it become a flux capacitor?
I'll tell you what.
The 1.21 gigawatts?
This thing will put out a new mark about an inch and a half long.
If you want to pull a bad one on somebody, take one of them cathode ray tube televisions, and just go ahead and while somebody's watching your favorite program, if you're pissed at them, you go ahead and just put a piece of aluminum foil and it sticks to the screen real good. And that's like a capacitor because it has a lot of surface area. It stores a lot of electrons. And when they go to pull it out, there's 25 million. I'm sorry. It's a little lower than that. But when they go to pull that thing off there, it'll knock them for a loop. It's quite fun. But you got to have a vengeance to do it.
Yeah. Oh, it works.
Yeah, they cut the TV off for 5 minutes and go over there and go pull it off. That sucker will knock them for a loop. Because that phosphor screen behind it is also electrically conductive. And that makes one heck of a capacitor. It's everything that flyback puts out.
Well, see, the thing about it is, all this talk about high voltage and capacitors and the way that we're running electricity these days, people are just, everything's running so doggone inefficient, you know? It ain't no need to be spending 120 volts worth of AC to run something that only takes 9 volts AC.
Right.
And so with that said, if I can produce a massive amount of high voltage and change it into a completely different form of energy and then bring that back in on my terms as opposed to, you know, just letting it run rampant. You see what I'm trying to point out here?
Yep.
You can control how much voltage that you put to any given circuit if you want. You know, we got the technology to do it. Anyway, what I'm trying to say is, look, you know, it doesn't matter how that magnetic field is created. You know, you can either induce a magnetic field by spinning magnets past a coil of wire manually or mechanically, or you can actually build a circuit, such as with transistors and MOSFETs, to do it with a solid-state circuit. If you look really close towards the inverters that they use to turn DC into AC, that's exactly what they're doing, you know. Essentially, they're taking an AC current DC current and using it to make pulse DC, which in turn, you know, you can run your AC stuff off of. It's the process that kills you, the way that they're doing it, for sending that power into an inefficient circuit that basically, like if you take a 400-watt inverter and plug it to a battery and you keep it under a full load, that battery's not going to last a very long time unless you're putting juice back to it. You see what I mean?
Yeah, when you're going up, you're looking at 12 volts and you're going to 120 volts, that means you're using 10 times the amps that you're getting out.
from the battery.
Yeah, because you're needing the current flow that is required to do that. But let's say you take that same concept, and instead of putting it under a direct load, you just take that energy off and put it into a completely different state of matter to where, you know, it's not a resistive load. All it's doing is taking that high voltage and energizing a gas into the plasma state and producing heat and visible light. Well, what can you do with that heat and visible light? You see what I mean?
Right.
You can take that. You can take that heat away without ever affecting that main circuit. So if it only takes 12 volts to run this doggone circuit, and you can keep it down to a low amp draw because you're not actually pulling a heavy duty load off of it. For example, if you took that same 400 watt inverter and you hooked it, let's say you had two car batteries. One had 400 watt inverter that was running a 100 watt light bulb, and the other one had a 400 watt inverter that was running an LED strand. How much longer do you think the LED one would stay running as opposed to the one that was running the 100 watt light bulb?
No.
So that's my point. If you
can figure out how many watt hours you have before the battery gets to a voltage that's not good for the battery.
Yeah. So but either way, we know that the LED strand's obviously not going to draw as much on that circuit. So that means that circuit won't nearly have to draw as much in order to maintain that constant flow that would have took to run the 100 watt light bulb. So you're going to get a lot more time out of that configuration than you would be the other one. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
Alright, so if we're doing pretty much the same thing like we're doing with the LEDs, at the very least, we could extend the battery life and still get the energy that we want out the other side. It's just going to be in a completely different form that we can change back into another one that won't be pulling that load that it takes to do it. I hear birdies chirping.
Yeah, I need to record that sound.
It's a good sound.
Sound of a cricket.
Anyway, if I take and do the same concept with pulsing a coil of wire, you know, when you pulse a transformer and it's got a secondary on it, and you're pulling off of the secondary, that pulling off of the secondary actually interacts with the primary, the energy that it takes to keep that primary pulse up, charged upright. Well, if you're never pulling off of a secondary and all you're doing is catching a flyback off of the primary, then that all you're catching is when the field collapses. You're not catching the when the field's going up. You're just catching it as it collapses. So you're turning it on, turning it off, turning it on, turning it off. You see what I mean?
Right. Well, hey, you remember them audio transformers just before the speaker, 1,000 ohm to 8 ohm?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, it's the little red one right before the that little red coil just before the speakers. It takes turns the voltage all into a little bit of amps to help run the speaker. Anyway, the teacher in semiconductors got off into these coils, and he says, "Well, yeah, there's no danger. Yeah, there's no danger leaving these little coils and everything in your box along with the battery. It's not going to do nothing. You might burn the coil out or something like that." He said, "Transformers only work with AC." So I grabbed mine and the 9-volt battery. I said, "Here, hold these leads." And I stuck the 9-volt battery to it and pulled it off, and he jumped.
Huh.
I said, "Yeah, it's make and break."
Yeah.
Pulsating DC works just as good as AC in the transformer.
Yep.
It's when the magnetic flux changes that the second coil gets the goes right ahead and changes the voltage on the other side because it takes current.
Yeah, and that's,
so but it's during the make and the break. So I got them twice.
Yeah, and that's the key because if you're using a mechanical form to turn magnets, that's energy you have to put in. And the more you draw on the other side, you have to put more in order to maintain that. However, in an electronic circuit, if you're doing pulsing the same magnetic field into that coil, and you're not actually drawing off of the coil itself, you're just taking that energy away from the coil. Do you see the difference there?
Yep.
Well, that's what I'm talking about doing. That's why I got these circuits on the way, so that I can pull some coils, and I want to make sure that that flyback doesn't come back in and destroy the circuit, so we're going to put some diodes to it as well in order to keep the energy going the direction that we want it. See, the whole deal about Lenz's law is that people's understanding of how things work, you know, to some extent, it's right. Alright, well, if you induce a current into a coil of wire, it creates a counter force that's trying to shut that current down. It's nature trying to balance itself back out. But if you never invoke that by allowing the electron flow to go back into that coil, then you don't get that result. If you just pulse the coil up just long enough to allow nature to slap it back down, when nature slaps it back down, you grab that energy on the return, and you don't use near the much power to do it. You can do it with a pen light battery, for Pete's sake. I mean, all you're doing is pulsing a magnetic field. That's it. You're making essentially an electromagnet. And by the core, when that magnetism hits that core, you know, it magnetizes that that core for a brief instance. But if you sit there and hold it, you essentially got an electromagnet that you can pick other metal pieces up. But once you release that, that energy is going to be slapped back down by nature again. You see what I mean?
Yep.
And grab the energy on the way out instead of sitting there trying to fight with it to get it. You know, that's the whole key. You know, our transformers these days, they get hot for a reason. They got energy backed up. They got a resistive load going on. There's energy that wants to get through there, and you keep pulsing this doggone thing, and the energy keeps spiking, and so they got to figure out ways in order to keep that spike from coming back down and destroying your electronics. So they put resistors and stuff in there. Well, by definition, when a resistor's resisting a load, what's it do? It gets hot. You know, too much resistance and you burn the resistor up. Am I wrong?
No. Also, they add 1N914 general purpose diodes as a fuse for only one direction to keep to protect the circuit as well.
Yep.
You can't really tell when those are blown. You have to get down there with a magnifying glass to see through the clear case.
Well, so with that said, then they know that they're producing more energy than they want in a specific circuit, so they got to figure out ways to protect that circuit, and that should have been the key. Now, I'm talking about, instead of trying to protect that circuit from the start, ramp that voltage up as high as you can get it, send it off in a totally different direction, have you some diodes just in case one of them spikes makes it back, and take that energy off into a completely different direction without having to make that doggone circuit have to work hard. It works hard when it's trying to force a load. Matter of fact, you can see that in real life whenever you put an electric motor to an electric generator head and you start running that electric motor. We did this when Raymond was out here. We had an electric motor with some doggone pulleys that would bring it up to high RPMs. The moment we put that thing under a load such as a light bulb, that generator head, the magnetic field went back in that thing and it dropped on its face. Yeah. And as long as we didn't turn that that load on that made the direct connection back into it, then that thing spun fine and the other motor didn't get hot. We was using a battery charger. That's probably like a 6 amp or somewhere around about battery charger that we were using to run a 24 volt DC motor, and the energy was got so strong that it would literally kick the breaker off in that battery charger once it was under load. As long as you never put it under a load like that, then you didn't have that problem. You see what I mean?
Yo.
Well, while we were doing this, we also hooked up a a little fluorescent bulb starter with the argon inside there. And we were able to generate plasma. And inside that plasma, there's a little heating switch. And when the plasma got hot enough to actually cause that heating switch to make the circuit, the 150-watt light bulb would come on briefly for super bright, and then that generator would drop right on its face. Once again.
Not much resistance. Maybe too much argon?
No. It was the plasma was fine. It was the heat that the plasma produced that actually turned that switch on. That's what those bulb starters do. When you energize the plasma in there, it basically turns the power on and off so that you don't have a direct power going to that ballast. Because otherwise, if you just directly connect a ballast to it without something to regulate that deal, it'll keep ramping the voltage up and ramping the voltage up until it literally burns a hole in the side of the doggone bulb. And so they have to have a way to turn it on and off. The modern-day electric ballasts do it inside the circuitry, but the older style.
A question on this: How'd you get the argon into the fluorescent tube?
It was already there. They come in that way in the factory. You buy them straight out of the store like that.
Well, I thought they had just a mercury vapor. I didn't know they had a different gas in them.
No, they got. We're talking about two different things here. The light bulb, the fluorescent light bulb, is two. And the bulb starter itself is two different things.
Right.
If you look on the older style fluorescent bulb lighting system,
they got that little tin cylinder.
Yeah, that little cylinder. Yeah. If you pull that shelf that casing off of that little cylinder, you will see that it has a glass tube in it that is full of argon and has a little thermal switch inside of it.
Right.
Well, that thermal switch is what regulates the ballast to keep it from overcharging that bulb. Because the ballast, it's going to keep putting juice to that thing. And the more it continuously puts juice to it, the hotter the inside of that bulb becomes until you got those black marks at the end of it. And the bulb finally starts to glow orange and burns a hole through the glass.
Right. And they got a little wire filament that gets hot down there, too, in order to heat up the gas so it'll conduct.
Yeah. Well, once again, though, until that element inside that bulb gets hot, it doesn't close and make the connection that completes the circuit. So you still have the plasma. You see what I mean?
Right.
So take that doggone thermal switch completely out of it, because you're not going to be running a direct load like you normally would before. What you're going to do is take that heat energy off of that plasma through a tubing, whether it be stainless or copper or aluminum, doesn't matter. You know, basically the plasma is going to be surrounding the tubing inside that vacuum. And then whatever you circulate through that tubing is going to get hot. So that's where your heat transfer is going to occur. You see what I mean?
Yep. That reminds me, I went up to Boomer's here about a week ago, and I was going to get me one of them LED tubes that replace the fluorescent bulbs. Yeah, I was going to, and Jim said he had a couple, and he said he was going to give to him. I hadn't got them yet, but as soon as I get one, I know the LEDs have a certain voltage drop each, and I was told that they wouldn't drop down to 12 volts and run them straight. When I get one, I'm going to go ahead and slide all of that out of the tube, and I'm going to rewire that sucker where she will work on 12 volts, and that'll be an awesome thing.
Cool.
Well, I didn't mean to change the subject to get off it, but that's my plan.
No, if my calculations are correct, then these circuits are going to prove a point once I get them, because I believe that even your standard electric motor running direct off of, a DC power supply or whatever could run a whole lot more efficient if it was run this way. And so using the energy in a completely different fashion than directly connecting it to that battery is what I'm talking about. You see what I mean? Instead of having a direct connection to your generator head. You take the energy you want off of the generator. You send it out and you take it completely away from the generator. So no matter what, that generator is going to continuously produce its maximum amount according to how many ever RPMs you're running it at. It's not going to draw any more than it would be just to be running without a load on it. You see what I mean?
Yep.
So at the very least, take your generator head and makes it way more efficient because it's not having to work near as hard in order to give you what it is that you want. And I believe the same thing could be done with a pulse DC circuit that to run any electric motor out there without having to draw all the amperage that it takes to run it the way that it does because of the way that they run them. That make any sense?
Yep.
Yes. Wonderful.
I tell you what, another little thing about pulsating DC in an AC motor, the AC motor won't get up at that if you put it on the load.
Well, and that's another key to point out too about the heat portion of the deal. Right. Most motors fail because of the heat.
Right. You know,
huh?
See, whether you put it under a really heavy load and then it's super hot and burn up, but you put it under the same load with pulsating DC and it won't cool.
Well, proof of what you just said right there is the motors that we talked about, the Fisher & Paykel or the Samsung version of the direct drive or smart drive motor, the stator motors that they use pulse DC circuit. They are powerful enough. They got enough torque to run a washing machine that normally, back in the old days, had to have a transmission connected to it.
Right.
So they're producing enough torque to not only turn all the wet clothes and water inside the doggone deal, but to do it in a way that it ain't burning that motor up every time you turn around.
Right.
The guy at the appliance store where I got one of these motors from, actually I got two of them from him now, but he said that they very rarely ever have to change the stator. Said they almost never go bad. He said the only thing that goes wrong in those motors is either the magnet comes loose on the rotor or the Hall effect sensors fail or the circuit board goes bad. He said, but the stators, they never replace them. And there has to be a reason for that. If you're running a heavy-duty load in your washing machine all the time and it's not causing that thing to bog down to the extent that it causes it to heat up and burn your doggone motor out, then that ought to be something to say about what we're talking about. It's staying cool, just like you said.
Yep, this is good.
So, anyway, that's what I'm working on. You guys got any projects down there you're working on?
I'm working on this filter device, building a muffler and a radiator cooling system for a water cooling motor to, like I say, I'm just trying to see if I can do away with the battery. Not the battery, but the alternator. Just totally do away with it.
Well, I think it's possible. I know it's possible.
And charge the battery with the heat coming off the engine.
Buddy pretty much proved that when he put the solar panel on the top of his truck.
Yeah.
What a difference. I mean, that thing runs like, well, I ain't going to say the word, but it runs pretty. But you know, when I got that solar panel hooked up, that sucker, it makes quite a difference. I mean, I can walk up a hill with the trailer without shifting gears. So,
well,
that's sweet.
Did you ever get that, did you guys ever get connected to get that doggone ceiling fan motor?
No. I saw him twice, and you know what? That's the time I keyed in there, and Boomer slapped my hand for grabbing the mouse, and I said, who cut your hair? Then I left, and y'all said something about the motor, and he was gone. He came down one other time, and he forgot that.
He tried to run outside and catch
him,
but
he didn't. Until after he left.
I got it in my truck. I just keep forgetting to give it to him when I go down there.
Yeah, we'll see each other soon enough.
You all have to put a sticky note on your forehead somewhere.
There you go. That'll work.
The reason why I keep harping on that doggone deal is because it has really weak magnets in it, not like the neodymiums that people are putting in them things.
Hey, the first steel and fan wind turbine I made, I went down to Walmart, and they got 50 magnets in a pack, and it's some rubbery ceramics.
Yeah?
And they're kind of polarized. They're dual polarized. If you look at it from the top, you look at and divide it down the middle, the right side is north and the left side is south, and underneath it's the opposite. So it makes a full magnetic circuit in there. As soon as you stick it to two pieces of metal on both sides, it makes it stronger, and they do that on the weaker magnets. But yeah, that's okay. I mean, if I put the north sides towards each other and the magnets next to it, I wind up with a full width of north and a full width of negative on the next one. I did that. I put that out, man. I tell you what, when I put the prop to it and got down to the beach, man, it lit up a bunch of LEDs. That was the first one that I made. I gave it to Ozzy, and it hit 80 plus mile an hour winds several times a year because he's like a block from the beach. Caught a lot of high winds. So, yeah, that thing's still spinning down there in Virginia.
That X13 motor that I gave you,
yeah.
The magnets in it, there's four magnets, and each one is exactly what the motor was describing. They each side has a north and a south. So you got four magnets, and each magnet has a north and a south on the same side, so you actually have eight different poles.
Cool.
Right.
Well, the theory behind what it was I was talking about was that because those magnets aren't as strong as the neodymiums, they'll have a whole lot less cogging and should be able to pull some better RPMs on there.
Right.
Because it won't be as much drag. And so, if my theory is correct, with one of Muddy's his blades that he carves, his props, then that thing should pick up really easy in lower winds and actually be able to get up to some serious high RPMs and higher winds that should put out the high voltage that I'm talking about.
Yeah.
So I said, and I keep saying this, and I keep getting myself in trouble all the time, I don't care about the current or the amps right now. I could care less about that. It's not what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to get as high voltage with the least amount of effort as possible.
And you agreed with me. Voltage, high voltage is no problem. It's the amperage that requires a lot of power.
Yeah, well, we'll get that later.
Yeah, them ceiling fan wind turbines, they didn't put out many amps because the wire was small. All the resistance is linings, but they had no problem with voltage. They were great for. I ran 12 strands of LEDs, Christmas lights, and I calculating the power and the amperage that I was using and the voltage. Looking at the wattage of each string, I could have added 12 more to keep the voltage down. They don't start conducting until it gets to right at about 80 RPM, and those things are used to running about 300. But they act like a voltage regulator. As soon as it passes that knee of voltage window, the amperage goes up very fast, so it slows the blades down. I had 140 volts on it using the AC off it, and I had to plug my laptop into it to charge my laptop into the end of the Christmas lights to get the voltage back down to 120. I almost blew some of it. That's what I did.
Can you custom build one of those props that will mount on I believe it's a half inch shaft for an X13 motor?
Yes, I can. You remember Ryan Abrams carved his own prop and put it on there, and he said it busted the shaft off. The half shaft isn't all that much, but my blades are much, much lighter, and I could make them a little shorter where it'll actually spin up, but half the length of the prop, you wind up with four times less power. But I'm sure you can reach the voltage, not a problem.
Yeah, I'm not going to put it under direct load ever. And so, I couldn't care less about wattage and amperage at this time. All I want is the high voltage portion of it.
Right.
And so from listening to you guys talk, even the ones with the stronger neodymium magnets in there, as long as I'm not putting it under a direct load, it's not going to get the cogging like you would, drop the amperage or whatever by the load you put on it. I don't care about all I want is the high voltage. I want the pressure. That's it. And then I'll show everybody how, once I get the high voltage the way that I want it, I'll show everybody how to put that high voltage back into usable current again.
Well, it's absolutely no problem whatsoever to get a ceiling fan DMA to put out 400 to 500 volts. No problem at all.
Well, that's what I need. And that's why I wanted to see that one that I put together with one of Muddy's props connected to it to see what kind of voltage that thing would pull out.
Did he change the windings at all?
No, Scott. He just used ceramic magnets from Home Depot.
Yeah, and I did that.
They're so weak that it turns with practically no cogging at all. Therefore, you can spin it up really fast with almost no energy and knock out some serious voltage.
Yeah, and I didn't modify any of the wiring for a purpose. There's a reason behind why I didn't modify any of that wiring. I want to be able to take just any motor off the store shelf to be able to put some magnets inside that thing and produce a high voltage generator right off the store shelf. Without all you had to do is buy your magnets and your epoxy and follow the step-by-step directions, and then bam, there you go, you got a high voltage generator.
Question for you.
Yeah.
The outside circumference of that motor, is it flat or is it one of those that have a lip that you put bolts through?
I believe it's flat.
Wonderful. Yeah, you can sit there and take a pair of bicycle forks and just go ahead and widen the hole at the end there and mount the shaft that runs through, because that's supposed to stay stable. You can go ahead and mount it on them forks and drop it right on the back of a bicycle wheel and go and jack that thing up and pedal it, and you get some good RPMs out of that thing. And, you know, it doesn't really matter how much RPMs you put on those things, because the magnets are on the outside and gravity helps keeps the magnets in place. So,
yes,
that's a great test, even if you put a motor to the chain.
That's the beautiful part about the X-Up-T motor and the ceiling fan PMAs, is the magnets on the outside, and it's the magnets that turn, so the spinning of it, the centrifugal force, actually, it doesn't hurt you at all. It helps you. It helps keep the magnets out where they're supposed to go.
Just like a smart drive.
Yeah, if you, like epoxy to the man, if you don't get your epoxy just right, you could throw it off balance. That's the only way that the speed's going to hurt you at all. Otherwise, if it's balanced perfect, you could put them up to 6, 7, 8,000 RPM without a problem at all. The bearings will take it.
Well, see, oh, yeah.
You get a current drop the higher the voltage goes, because it doesn't have time for the current to actually flow, because it's happening so fast. But that's cool with me. I don't want the current flow, because I'm not going to use it in the conventional sense. All I want is that frequency to raise up as high as possible, the voltage raise up as high as possible, to literally energize gas into the plasma state. Once I get it to the plasma state, which is super easy, we've done it. When Raymond was out here, we got that thing up to about 460 volts AC off the X13, and we got plasma inside that gas tube.
Yes, we did.
And that's all I needed. That's why, you know... I didn't come about it the right way and explain it to everybody the way I should have, and I probably would have saved myself a whole lot of cussed out and heartache. But I was trying to point something out to them. I don't need the current watts at the stage that I'm in right now. All I care about is the high frequency, high voltage. That's it.
Right, lightning hit your butt and chasing you around the yard.
Yeah, you can have all the current you want inside the doggone argon tube, but it's not going to energize it into the plasma state until that frequency raises up. You see what I mean?
Yep. Yeah, I'm going to say it again, but that's where I proved your theory here by lighting up 15 fluorescent light bulbs on less than a tenth of the power that they should have used.
Yeah, it's the voltage that lights them bad boys up.
Yes, it is, not the amperage.
Yep.
Got to have a little bit of current, that's it.
Right. I would light them up with 3.4 watts of electricity per bulb, and they normally they require 28 watts.
You know, when I see something that's really cool, I start laughing. I laughed my butt off when I saw them things strung out. I said, oh, you replaced the LEDs with them bad boys now. He can see everywhere.
Really? No joke. I got about 40 or 50 of those T8 light bulbs. Now, they're not burnt out, but they still burn using that Beck and Oil burner. I'm going to bring you about 40 or 50 of them, sure, to see you, and some aircraft cable.
I'll take one.
To string them up on, just like I did in my place. You light up your whole backyard, man.
Cool.
Not to be in a roll, I'll take one, though.
For what?
You got 40 or 50 of them to give away. Give me one.
Oh, man, I'll give you as long as you want. I throw them away all the time. They're T8 fluorescent bulbs.
Right.
Well,
I'm back at the oil transformer.
I tell you, whenever I started digging these things out of trash, people started to give me the crooked eye. What do you want those for? You know? They don't. They're no good. And then when I took a 9-volt battery and lit one up that was out of the trash right in front of them, their jaw about hit the floor.
Yeah, right.
Now, how you doing that? And I explained to them the process. You know, it's the frequency that this coil is putting off that's energizing the gas inside this bulb. As long as you never breach the seal on the vacuum of that bulb will last forever.
Yeah.
And all you have to do is be able to have it in within the field of the right frequency, and it'll energize it and give you off the visible light. And the stronger the field, the brighter the bulb. Well, if that can be done with a doggone 9-volt battery, imagine what you could do with a 12-volt battery and the process that I'm talking about.
You know, the thing is, though, Shaliz, if you were to clean that white powder off the inside of one of those bulbs, you wouldn't see the light at all.
No.
All you'd see is maybe a little bit of plasma.
Well, that would be cool.
It's a white powder in there. It's phosphor, and it absorbs the light and gives off a visible light. And it's a slight mixture for different colors.
Right. It's the infrared is exciting the white phosphorus on the powder on the inside of the bulb. That's what turns it into visible light.
It's funny because a lot of people, if you ever go out there on eBay and you look up spectrum tubes, they cost about somewhere around about $12 a piece. And spectrum tubes are, you know, basically for testing different light ranges, like frequency ranges of light, you know, different spectrums of light. That's it. But what they didn't realize that you got a diode right there, man. The same doggone concept of the mercury arc rectifier from back in the late 1800s. Is the same concept what's going on there. If you send in high voltage into one side and you got it connected to the other side, you get a pretty little light inside there. But that high voltage is building up pressure inside that bulb and will only allow the electrons to flow in one direction. You see what I mean?
Yep.
So when you see in my videos on my plasma reactor, that's essentially what it was being used for, as a diode. So, you know, and then you can speed it up and slow it down by the spark gap. When Justin was talking about spark gaps earlier and running Tesla coils, you know, I can pulse that Tesla coil at any speed that I want. Ryan Abrams just did a brilliant video here recently where he had a pulsed circuit going on with the deal to interrupt the pulse every so often. And you just have to watch Ryan's latest video, and you'd be impressed to see what he was doing with that. He was taming lightning, essentially.
Yeah.
You know, Ryan's brilliant. He does a lot of really cool stuff, man. But his stuff could go so much further if people would pay attention to the anomalies that he's been showing. You know, he took a Peltier element and a little electric motor and made it where the heat of his wrist was actually turning that electric motor with the Peltier element.
Yeah, that was pretty cool.
So, there you go, man. It's all.
What I liked best was that he took one of them rotisserie motors from the middle of the, in the middle of your microwave.
Yeah.
That thing is geared up like you wouldn't believe. Now, it's meant to run off the 60 hertz, and then it's geared down to move that tray slow. But when you start turning that shaft really fast, if you turn it the same RPMs on that shaft that it normally gets with the rotisserie, you get 120 volts. When you start cranking that sucker, you're moving a lot faster, and it puts up a lot of voltage. He has a decent capacitor on that thing. He just cranks about three turns and charges up that capacitor, and that LED stays lit for a long time, a lot longer than them crank-up flashlights. And I'd say it's a lot cheaper because it's free.
Yeah.
None of the shaking your arm till your muscles hurt to keep the thing on for 5 minutes.
The
very
first time that I ever saw that in action was I was watching a video where a guy was taking apart a microwave oven and finding parts because he was actually going to build a hydrogen cell using the stainless out of it. Well, he was sitting there holding his motor, and he cranked it over, and the two prongs were touching his hand, and he drops it real quick and shocks himself, and I'm like, no, he didn't get that much of a bite out of that doggone thing. And sure as heck, I got one out and went and tested it, and took one put in the name of science. I held on to that sucker, and I spun it around. Of course, I had a little more torque than he did because the one he had was just a little knob. I had that one that had the actual big long legs on it. And so I spun that sucker around and lit myself up, man.
I told you you like high voltage.
Yeah.
Well, we had a guy down here. His name was his name is Rick. Rick Porter. Anyway, he owns Rick's Appliance and Repair. And he likes to scrap as well. And he saw like 8 or 9 microwave ovens sitting off there on the side all stacked up because I was going to take the MOTs out of it, microwave oven transformers, and I was going to take the rotisserie motors out, and I was going to take the Celerons out of it. And I told him, I said, no, those ain't for scrap. I told him what I needed out of them. If you're going to scrap them, you can take them. Just as long as you get those parts out, and you can scrap the rest. Well, the only thing I got was the magnetrons and one rotisserie motor. And when I said, dude, I needed those MOTs real bad. And he says, well, I couldn't get them out. I said, well, drill the rivets. That's all, if you couldn't get them out, then bring them back. I said, I needed those things. That was my value. That's why I said I'd let you have them for free. And I wanted those rotisserie motors because they generate a lot of electricity. He said, no, they don't. I said, oh, yeah, they do. So I handed him back the thing. I said, here, put those little terminals on your tongue and just give it a small spin. And he was still in big disbelief. I tell you what, he cranked that sucker and he was speaking in tongues.
I can believe that.
He didn't realize he got zapped with 400 volts at a very small microamps, but hey, it's enough. Well, it took him a minute before he could talk right.
If you get an opportunity to get a hold of any more of those microwave oven transformers, hold on to them because they're going to start becoming rare. Those older microwaves are going to the scrapyard, and we're losing a valuable resource there because now they're using these doggone inverter technologies in microwaves.
They're not hard to make, though.
Well, no, but I would rather already have one made that I didn't have to tinker around with.
Yeah, my son, he started training 2 days ago, and he should be going out tonight and going right on the job. And when he changes these big helium argons or whatever they want to call them that for the parking lots, they look like microwave oven transformers, except the secondary is much, much bigger because those things are using 400 volts.
Cool.
He's going to get me a few of those. Wow. And those will be just as good as microwave oven transformers, trust me. I'll be able to put some windings on that bad boy, even real fat ones.
I'd like to have about 12 of the microwave oven transformers so I can take the primaries and the secondaries out of them. and put them in a system like your actual flux wind turbine.
That would be
great. Right.
Now, could you imagine if you had the normal primary and the secondary basically embedded in the resin like you do your coils that you've done already, and you've got actually both of them? One would carry more current and the other one would carry high voltage.
Right.
Can you think of any use for that? And actually,
well, anything that's multiple current and multiple voltage is always useful.
An actual flux wind turbine built to those specifications would be impressive.
And you'll get out what you put in them almost,
yep.
Up to 97%. So yeah, that's great. I mean, when you get steel cores in your coils, you automatically drop the efficiency of a motor down to 45.
Well, check this out. Let's say you want to charge up a battery bank. You could actually flip a switch and change from the high voltage primaries to the high voltage or the lower voltage, higher current primaries. The secondaries, you can switch from the secondaries to the primaries. You see what I'm saying?
Remember my video that said ceiling fan wind turbine Christmas lights?
Yeah.
And what I did on that, you know, I have two bridge rectifiers. I got two bridge rectifiers, and the ACs were connected together on both. The ACs were connected. I'm sorry, the plus and the minus outputs of those rectifiers were connected together. And that went to my battery bank. Now, the ACs were connected to one diode bridge rectifier had one set of coils, and the other bridge rectifier had the other set of coils. What I did was I put one jumper across the start and the finish of the two sets of coils. In other words, I joined the ACs on one side of the block that I made, and I took the output of that AC before it was rectified and ran the Christmas lights with it. So the Christmas lights would not light up until I disconnected from the battery. The voltage would go up and run the LEDs. And as soon as I connected it to the battery, it automatically shifted to charging the batteries. So that was pretty handy. All I had to do is if I wanted more current on the batteries and it was more charge on the batteries and it was daytime, just connect the other clip to the other side of the battery, and the lights would go out, and and the LEDs would not conduct at all because they had a breakover voltage, and the voltage would go to the batteries, and what over voltage it was trying to reach would turn into amps. And all I had to do is turn the lights on at night, go out there, and unclip it from the battery, and it should have had a full charge by then. So, I mean, it was a trickle charge at best, but hey, I like versatility.
Well, I know that those doggone washing machine motors that I've been talking about, the stator motors, the smart drive motors, whatever you want to call them, I know that they're really powerful because that one, I had to actually buy me two new bridge rectifiers like the one I got from Raymond because it was like 1,000 volts at 100 amps, and I actually burnt one of those things up.
That's a lot of money.
Yeah, well, yeah, I was not very happy when I burned it up. I was actually really seriously frustrated because I needed it, but I went out and bought two more of them identical to it. But the fact that I was able to burn that thing out with that motor, that was pretty impressive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's 1,000 volts at 100 amps. That should have been able to hold up to that doggone thing, but it didn't.
That's 100,000 watts, man.
Well, it's the amperage that burns it out. So if you didn't get to the voltage and it wanted more current, you'd have reached that real quick. That's why fuses are rated in amps, not voltage. Some of them have a voltage to them.
Well, don't you think that that's pretty impressive that spinning that thing up with a doggone drill was able to burn that doggone bridge rectifier out?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, that's what I'm talking about, man.
Well, what do you have it hooked to?
I had it hooked to that Samsung smart drive motor, and I was running some lighting systems with it. And I fired that thing up and burnt the doggone thing out. I was better off without running that with the bridge rectifier directly with the doggone AC, because the AC was enough to light it up anyway, but I was trying something different to see if with the DC load would be less drag on the motor than it would on the other. And apparently I was correct, because when I did it, the light bulb did light up, but the rectifier burned up.
What blew my mind is I looked at the fine windings inside a hard drive motor, and I said, oh, man, that ain't no good. There's no amps coming out of that bad boy. But when you spun that hard drive motor up and were lighting up all sorts of things, I was like, whoa, that blew my mind. I didn't know it would handle that.
Well, yeah, that's the key. If you look inside those doggone motors, there's hardly any copper wire in there. And the magnet is not anything to brag about, you know.
But yeah, it is. From the output I saw.
Well, yeah, now, but I mean, beforehand, if he's going to use that magnet for any other alter purpose or whatever, it really didn't have a lot of strength to it. So, you know, probably wouldn't even hold up your kid's picture on the refrigerator, you know. But
as a matter of fact, those rotisserie motors out of the microwave, if you just put one little you put a sealant band blade on that sucker and just put it flat to the wind and let the wind move it back and forth, man, I bet you could burn LEDs all the time. Even a slight breeze would move the sucker and charge the capacitor back up. All you need is a voltage regulator to burn the excess off the ground. And yeah, don't worry about the waste. It's not like it's going to go a full rotation and all that stuff. It's not going to spin like a blade, just more like a paddle, you know?
The only problem I see with that deal is that if you get too many RPMs, you'll shred those gears in there, because they make them out of plastic. If you can find one that's got like metal gears in there that'll last longer, that'd be great. Because
yeah, I got one with metal gears, but the thing is, it's not gonna rotate. It's just going to kind of go back and forth. And it'll hang down. When the wind blows, it'll move it to the side and move it back, and that would be enough.
Yeah.
Because you turn that thing like three cranks, and the LED just stayed lit for a while. And I was like, yeah, Bubba, I want four or five of those.
Well, there you go, man. So
I thought that was awesome. And he had a resistor, load resistor across it to keep the voltage down. Because the resistor was part of the voltage divider compared to the voltage inside the LEDs that it takes to break it over. So,
what size prop would you need, Scott, to turn one of those?
Well, you won't want to put a prop on it. Just put one blade on it, kind of like a butterfly switch. It moves every now and then back, and, you know, and then the wind stops, it'll go down, or it changes direction, it'll move it sideways, even like maybe 15, 20 degrees. I'm pretty sure it would keep the LED lit.
Well, couldn't you use like one of them tail fins like you use on to guide the old style windmills?
Oh, that's too big. Too big. Matter of fact, the sealant fan, one sealant fan blade hanging off the shaft would probably be too big. Probably have to cut it in half, cut half the length off.
No, I'm saying as those things, because they change with the wind. You know, that's what guides that blade into the wind, so that it will still be able to turn, because the wind's changing.
I'd have to say that basically any direction of wind except straight on,
yeah,
would move it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But yeah, you could put a fin on it so it would actually work that way all the time. And even if the wind got up high, it fluctuates, and that it would just move a little bit as gravity pulled it back down, and then go back up as the wind changed. So that's why I'm saying it wouldn't overvolt anything.
All right, well, we're getting to the close of the deal here, but if you ever get a chance to get a hold of that doggone motor that I sent out there and deal, you think you can do a video on it so I can see how much voltage that thing will put out?
Sure, we'll clock the RPMs on the tire and figure out the ratio of turns.
Yeah.
Just put it on. I mean, that rubber wheel will grip it real nice. We'll go ahead and give it a spin and see what we get out of it.
We're never going to put it under a direct load. If anything, have it shooting across the spark gap to a capacitor bank to store that charge, and then that when that capacitor gets high enough, it'll shoot across to another bank.
We could put a diode in series with the to get a half wave set up on it and put that across to make a Tesla coil and see if we can light that bad boy up too.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
To light up all the fluorescent tubes I got here from Boomer. I will string them out across the yard through the trees.
There you go.
Well, yeah, I've got about a 7-foot Tesla coil out there in my backyard now being pulsed by a 4-volt battery, so I know it can be done.
Where'd you find a 4-volt battery?
It's in a 4-volt fence charger.
Ah, gotcha.
And basically, it basically takes that 4 volts, charges up the battery all day long, and pulses, I can't remember how many volts through the doggone thing. But literally, you do not want to touch it.
Matter of fact, I got in a piece of property I got somewhat gifted. I have to pay $125 back. In the shed there was a fence transformer.
Yeah, you'll have a lot of fun with them if you. Is it a solar one or is it the one you got to plug into AC?
It's one you got to plug into AC, but that's no problem.
You can still have fun with that one too, but I like the solar ones. All right, well, it's down to it, man. You guys got any last comments or notes or YouTube channels or anything you want to throw in there?
Nope.
Nope. There's one no. What about you, Muddy?
Oh, all sorts of things, but I could go on forever and you'd go over, so. I'll just say what Larry says. Just do it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You can do it. That's pretty much what my videos all say, you know. I could have used the word redneck, but you stole that word, so I just title my stuff and I show people, you know, hey, you can do it. You can cast a stator, you can make a generator, anybody can, and I show all the different deals. If you see a how-to, analyze that sucker all the way down to the end, go out there and you say, I can't do that. Well, just try it, just like carving a prop. People put a nick in the wood on a $2.76 piece of 2x4. Oh no, the prop. They're afraid to touch the 2x4. Look, just cut and start cutting. If you got a big gap, I've had several people tell me, you know, oh, I gouged it real good. I said, well, gouge the other side until it balances. The wind doesn't really care all that much. It's just a little ripple. You might lose 2 or 3%. Just put the prop up in the air. When you're done, you're going to look at it and say, that thing looks like crap. But you're going to watch it spin slow, and all of a sudden it's going to catch the right angle of attack as it starts spinning and cutting the air. And eventually the air is going to run across the airfoil and get lift, and all of a sudden the sucker's going to go, and you go, whoa, it spun up real quick. And that's that lift is responsible for 3/4 of your power. So you put that thing up there, and you look at it, and you say, that's a piece of crap, but I made it. Darn, it works. You'll be hooked on carbon props from then on. You'll look at a 2x4 and say, yeah, it's only $2.76. You'll start making cut after cut in less than a second, man.
Yep.
So, just do it.
What about you, Justin?
Not much.
Just do it.
All right, well, just do it, folks. You've been listening to Mad Science. I appreciate everybody joining in, and if you are interested in joining the Knights of the Round Table tomorrow, 8 a.m. Central to 11 a.m. Central, come on over and let's get some stuff done, man. It's as simple as that. Don't ever underestimate high voltage, because I'm going to show you what you can do with it. Peace and love, everybody. Stay tuned.
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission: to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Crap.
Operator, give me the number for 911.
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch it.